lights on now. Okay, call to order the meeting of Safety and Security Committee. Any questions on the agenda? If not, we'll proceed with the agenda. And we have minutes from the last meeting. Can I have a motion to approve the minutes? Any questions on the minutes? If not, without objection, the minutes are approved. Let's have the safety briefing, safety reminder.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you. First, I'll start off with emergency procedures. In the event the fire alarm would be activated, you'd hear a loud audio noise and visual clear strobes. Ask that you exit through the doors here behind me and through the front doors of the Jackson Graham Building across the street to the lawn of the building museum to where we would assemble and make sure everyone has safely exited the building. On the safety contact, even though today's weather and the prediction or the forecast may not be such, but wanted to touch on lawnmower essentials. As we know, springtime is upon us, and that means many of us will soon be pulling out the lawnmower, unless you have a lawn service, and knowing and observing a few basic safety measures will help you effectively care for your lawn while minimizing injury to yourself and innocent bystanders. So we'd ask that you know your equipment, read the owner's manual. I know we hate to read instructions, but that's a good recommendation. If you haven't recently serviced your mower, you may want to make that a priority. Leave all safety features intact. Don't tie down the handle that stops the mower if for some reason you fall. Clear the area of any to be mowed of any sticks, rocks, or other debris that may fly and hit yourself or someone else. Keep children and pets out of the mowing area. Cut the grass only when conditions are safe. Don't mow in the dark or when the grass is wet or slippery, such as today. Wear appropriate personal protective equipment to include boots and safety glasses and hearing protection. And then, given the potential for injury, following these steps will help you maintain a safe environment while operating your lawn. That concludes safety contact. Chairman Delmy.
We'll open up with the talk briefing from Matt Bassett. Good morning, Matt.
Morning. Thank you, Mr. Downey. We're pleased to return for our quarterly update to the Metro Board. As you know, my name is Matt Bassett. I'm the chair of the Tri-State Oversight Committee. We just have a couple pieces of business to get through today. Our general assessment of progress since our last presentation here on December 16th of last year is that the overall trends are positive. In particular, the roadway worker protection training is progressing appropriately. I might amend that to say remarkably. I'll get to that in more detail a little bit later. I also wanted to commend the accident investigation progress with the addressing a backlog of unfinished or otherwise incomplete accident investigations. I'll talk about that in some detail. Both TOC and WMATA have made progress in addressing concerns identified by the Federal Transit Administration of their audit that they issued about this time last year. And we do have a couple concerns we wanted to bring up, one among them being the rule compliance issue in rail yards.
Just starting off discussing CAPS, which for those of you who aren't familiar, stands for Corrective Action Plans. These are the processes by which Metro tracks responses to safety concerns. The progress, I realize, I'm glad we did get the February in there. The initial draft of this didn't have anything about February, but there was some progress.
Sorry, I can't hear you. Can you pull the mic a little?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I was concerned that my most recent version of the slides didn't include the February, but it does. December and January progress was relatively marginal. I'd mostly attribute that to the fact that there was a lot of work going on simply preparing the response to the TOX triennial, and so there wasn't a lot of time to address the other outstanding corrective action plans. But progress in February and March has been noticeable. A lot of that had to do with the System Safety Program Plan. As you know, TOC is required to review and approve WMATA's System Safety and Security and Emergency Preparedness Plans. With our approval of the SSPP, which we issued last month, a number of open findings related to that document were able to be closed. It wasn't all that. There were also some
areas of concern identified by the Office of the Inspector General that had to do with our rail safety mission, as well as audit findings from addressed to the Track and Structures Department and Safety Department that were also closed. I think it's important to note that the prioritization of corrective action plans, of WMATA's internal ability to say that this particular program, this particular effort is worthy of significant support, and conversely, WMATA's ability to say this is important, but this is not as high of a priority as some of these other actions, that is probably the most key effort in the ongoing management of the of this document, of these action items. I think that there has been significant progress made in using a hazard identification method of going through and using the accepted military standard, I believe it's 882, to assess the probability of one of these identified areas of concern actually resulting in a problem, and the severity of that problem if it were to occur. And I think that the use of that method is going to be important, although I joked at the Executive Safety Committee that it will result in a lot of color printing. It is it's essential not just for the ability to for WMATA to prioritize their efforts, but it's also important to point to and say that while there may be a large number of open corrective action plans, that the most critical among them are also getting the most effort.
As you know, and as we'll talk with Mr. Doherty, we now do have a much larger number by virtue of the latest audit, by virtue of things that have been identified by the staff, but it is our intent to prioritize those and work off the most difficult and important ones first, which means the number may look large, but it hopefully will be the right composition.
Sure. I don't mean to step on Mr. Doherty's presentation, but there is a slide that we thought was very important to, in their presentation, that demonstrated that while there is a huge, a very large number of open corrective action plans, not quite half of them come from the TOC, and the other half come from other sources, some of which are the NTSB, but also many of which come from internal safety audits.
Which means we're doing our job.
Exactly. That's where I was. That's where I was going. There should always be open corrective action plans, and the more of them that come internal to the agency, the more evidence of there is that there is an ongoing rigorous self-assessment rather than just outside agencies. The that dovetails nicely with the internal audit program. We've reviewed WMATA's 2010 internal safety and security audit report. Overall, we're very pleased with the document. We're going to issue, as per our requirements under the federal regulation, we're going to issue a written approval in short order. Overall, the internal safety and security audit programs have made really significant progress. Obviously, the ability to analyze internally whether or not you're following your own rules and procedures and regulation is very important and complementary to an outside, you know, a regulatory or oversight agency. The quality of the we're also pleased to note that many of the audit findings are very similar to the ones that that we issue, which kind of validates our processes on both ends. One administrative note is that WMATA does need to ensure that the required notifications get made in the 30 days in advance of the audit. This is not a systemic problem. This is an administrative goof here or there, but it does need to ensure it gets done. Moving on to the Roadway Worker Protection Program, WMATA has really made some significant progress in ensuring and meeting their upcoming deadline to ensure that all necessary track workers not only are trained in the in roadway worker protection, but are trained at the appropriate level based on their duties and responsibilities. We within the TOC have taken RWP training in the recent months. I should also note that the Federal Transit Administration sent some representatives. The current program is obviously a significant leap over previous efforts. We're going to be monitoring the program's implementation. We plan to reassess it once it matures. Obviously, if we go out and audit it on the second day that it's in place, it's not going to be very valid. But we do expect to go out and assess it in the not-too-distant future. One of the interesting ancillary efforts of this program is the development of the worker ahead warning system, which is an entirely internal kind of built by Metro program of flashing lights that I believe is being tested between, I think it's Gallery Place and Judiciary. Is that it? There's a current test bed in place. We're very interested in going out and seeing the testing as it takes place, the idea being that workers, prior to entering the track bed, would flip a switch and an amber light system connected to the ETS, the blue light ETS boxes, would flash and would alert the train operator that in that there were workers in that area. Obviously, it's still a test bed. Metro needs to figure out if it works for them, but we're very interested in this, and we're looking forward to getting more information on it. I think it's also worth noting that the RWP training, there were a large number of employees that were originally scheduled for the level one training, and they ended up deciding that the employees and their management determined that it was more appropriate for them to take a more advanced, an additional level of training, which has put an additional burden on the training program, but has not, doesn't appear to have prevented them from continuing to meet their targets. So we're pleased that there's even more, there's an even higher of baseline level of training for many of these employees.
And have your TACT employees been through the training?
Yes. We've taken it. Some of our contractors have taken it. We're very pleased with what we've seen. The level of professionalism of the instructional staff and the clear effort that went into putting together this RWP program really, it's very visible. So we're very happy with this area. In the long term, our most important area that we want to be analyzing, and I think one of the areas that Metro staff in their interactions with other agencies with our significant RWP programs is that the found is that the audit function, the ability to assess compliance with these rules at, you know, the frontline employee level, first line supervision, management, superintendent, all the way up, having a robust audit program is really key to the success of, and when we say audits, this is a more of an operational audit than, say, a system safety or a system security level, quote, desk audit. This is, you know, field analysis. So we will be coming back to especially see how the audit function matures. And Metro's given us the opportunity to review a draft audit plan for this, and so far we're pretty pleased with the direction it's going. Obviously, there have been some elevator escalator safety concerns in the last few months since we presented in December. In that time, we've had the opportunity to attend some elevator escalator training and visit some of those facilities. Some of our personnel responded to the Foggy Bottom GW incident of February 18th. From our perspective, WMATA submitted five corrective action plans stemming from the original VTX report. Those have met with our approval, and we're satisfied with the plans they've developed coming out of that. Obviously, we're monitoring this issue on a continuing basis. In particular, we're pleased that the safety department has assigned a full-time escalator safety officer. We still have more to learn about this, and I won't step on Jim or Bob's presentation regarding the specific February 18th incident, but this is certainly on our radar screen.
But having someone who's specialized in this area should allow us to make a better investigation and ongoing review.
Certainly.
Yeah.
I've also been notified that I believe VTX is going to be assessing the final report coming out of that, and having that third-party evaluation is certainly expert evaluation is important. As you know, as has been reported in the last few days, we do have some concerns over a trend in the last few months relating to compliance with certain movement rules within the Metro rail yards. There has been a pattern of a few low-speed collisions within, you know, with a parked trains, bumping posts, in some cases shop doors. The TOC and the safety department are working with rail transportation to better understand the problem. The fact that we're bringing up this concern should not in any way be construed as an indictment of frontline employees. Our work with Metro in analyzing this issue has just begun, and there are levels of processes, environment, operating conditions, equipment, people, and management that all need to be looked at before the TOC or Metro can reach any conclusions and say this or these reasons are why this is going on. But we're going to be conducting site visits and evaluations with safety department and operations staff over the next few weeks. We appreciate Metro's very speedy response when we brought this concern up, and we appreciate their openness and their willingness to allow us out there and to give us the access that we need to do an independent evaluation.
Is this issue across the system, or is it localized?
It's not localized to one particular yard. As you know, they're identified by the Federal Transit Administration, but dating back to about 2006, there were a series of accident investigations that were under the federal standard and or the TOC standard required, but were not, in fact, completed. WMATA has launched what I've informally referred to as something of a Manhattan Project to address the backlog of accident investigations, and these efforts have been exemplary, and they've paid off. The majority of pre-2010 accident investigation reports have been completed. That's very significant. As of this time last year, WMATA had open investigations that were dating back as late as 2006.
I think it's pretty hard to investigate something that happened 5 years ago.
It is, and it requires not only an operating knowledge of the system, but some detective work to go back and say who do I need to talk to?
Cold cases, right?
Cold case would be a good comparison for it. 88 of the 100 open investigations cited by the Federal Transit Administration have since been completed. And we look forward to working with Metro and safety and operations staff to close the rest of them. Once that occurs, there's a Federal Transit Administration audit finding directly related to this that they've indicated that they will close out upon the completion of these. Obviously, we can't simply wave a wand and make these go away and say, well, we want them gone and Metro wants them gone. But Metro's done a very good job of providing accident investigation reports, even for these coldest of the cold cases that are detailed, that meet our standards, and that close the loop. Overall, there's various areas of the operation that TOC and safety have been making progress in gaining access to meetings and discussions. I think there, for example, recently we were invited to a meeting, sort of a summit within the Rail Operations Department of various projects, some kind of a status meeting of various projects all relating to the improvement and overhaul of the automated train control system. And that went for about 2 hours, and that was a very significant learning experience. So we appreciate the openness of Mr. Kubicek and his staff to let us get access to these things. I think overall, just in terms of institutional communication, despite the fact that we understand that open corrective action plans are not necessarily bad, that even old open corrective action plans are not necessarily bad if it's for a significant project, such as, for example, the exterior door releases.
Are being done on a regular schedule.
They're being done, and the concern that we have comes from old corrective action plans that have not been attended to, that are overdue, that are in need of a status update. And the fact is that there are almost none of those that are currently in place. So it's the opinion of our organization that once the kind of apprehension over what may seem like a very long document, once the understanding of the fact that these can be prioritized, once that filters down, then I think we'll be in our ability to get some of these issues resolved will be further enhanced.
And part of the whole process of developing a safety culture is the willingness to look at ways to improve and treat that as an important agenda item.
Absolutely. I mean, these are important because they demonstrate that the actions are being tracked and that, you know, things coming out in an audit finder and accident investigation, the loop is being closed. Regarding the Federal Transit Administration's audit, as of March 7th, you can see when I started writing the PowerPoint slide, as of March 7th, the FTA had closed 4 WMATA recommendations and 6 TOC findings. There may have, if they've closed any in the last couple of days, I don't have this updated, but we do anticipate additional closures both of WMATA items and TOC items within the next 60 days. There are a few long lead items regarding hazard management, the revision of certain documents, and as I noted previously, the resolution of open accident investigations. But we'll continue to work closely on that. The closure of some of these items, in particular the hazard management finding that was addressed both to TOC and WMATA, is going to require additional, you could call it an audit, you could call it an assessment. The semantics are less important than the fact that we will need to close this audit finding, come back and analyze Metro's implementation of their safety measurement system and the use of that system to fulfill their responsibilities for hazard management. And that may take 6 to 9 months, possibly more, because again, we are apprehensive about auditing something that has not been fully, that is not fully in use. As I noted, the TOC was approved, WMATA's System Safety Program Plan. Again, this is the guiding document that the agency uses to lay out their processes for system safety management and has a number of supporting documents, procedures, policies. We've reviewed the Security and Emergency Preparedness Plan. We have some comments on that, and we're working with them to address it. They've been very responsive with us. We're looking forward to reviewing a revised accident investigation procedures. The previous accident investigation procedures have been under review for a little while, and we understand that they're making good progress on that. But once we see those, we're looking forward to the opportunity to give comments. As you may know, under the federal regulation, the TOC is, in fact, the agency charged with investigating accidents at Metro. We delegate for incidents meeting a certain list of criteria. We delegate that authority, as most other, actually, I believe all other state safety oversight agencies do nationally, to Metro, reserving the right to either conduct the investigation ourselves if we so choose, or conduct a joint investigation with Metro, but we have a standing delegation of authority to Metro to conduct their own accident investigations, but the caveat for that is that they're required to submit their accident investigation procedures to us for approval. Another document that is being updated that we look forward to reviewing is their Metro Safety, I believe it's the Procedures Manual. This is not to be confused with the rule book, since I myself was confused about it repeatedly. This was identified in the FTA's audit and needs to be updated to address one of their findings.
Reviews, have you looked at the current state of play with respect to Safety Department review of engineering changes?
Safety Department review of
engineering changes? Yes.
I believe there was some media coverage about that. My understanding is that the EMIs are being submitted on a regular basis, as well as
for approval.
Yeah. Other documents like site-specific work plans are all being submitted and reviewed as per current procedures. That's our understanding right now. I recognize the concern that may not have happened in the past.
Yeah.
From our available information, that process is working.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to ask that if Mr. Bassett would explain the differences between the two, because as I looked at them, I know we have done the rule book and it's available,
yes.
And that is for our workers. What is different about the procedures, and what is the distinction for me?
My understanding about this procedures manual is that it was a guiding document of safety department level policies, but I'll let Jim explain it because it's somewhat outdated.
It's a corporate level safety rule book where the Metro Rail one specifically are for the rail employees, and this would be a rule book that covers all WMATA and Metro employees.
Thank you. Just regarding governance issues, as you know, the TOC internal and the TOC WMATA MOUs have been fully executed. At the encouragement of Mr. Sarles, we held a partnering session in January that really helped to identify further areas in which areas where we could use some improvement in terms of our interaction with Metro. Basically, an opportunity to sit in this room for most of the day and talk about where the areas of friction were in our relationship as agencies, and where the areas that were going well and could be built upon. You know, areas such as some specific clarifications about notification, for example, corrective action plans, that kind of thing. And I think less so having to do with the individual action items we came out of it. I think we came out of there in general with a better relationship as an organization, as organizations. Regarding the governance reform efforts, we just noted that, our secretaries of transportation are participating in these, and will respond to whatever direction they issue us. I just would note that whatever governance reform activities happen here at WMATA are going to have an effect on our long-term plans for how we grow the TOC as an organization. So we're obviously going to be monitoring this fairly closely. Regarding the safety measurement system, as I noted previously, we've taken the safety measurement system training, and at the workstation that WMATA said that the safety department has set up for us, they're going to be providing us with capability to review and access it, although obviously not enter any information into the system. As a reminder, the safety measurement system is the now in place electronic database that Metro uses to track accident investigations, reported hazards, to close the loop on everything from a fender bender with a bus to a call to the safety hotline, and to provide the capability to easily incorporate input from all levels of the organization to resolve an accident investigation. We're very pleased with what we've seen of it. Obviously, it needs to be a mature system. It needs to be used to track all reported hazards, to track all incidents, whether that's reportable ones such as those that meet our standard, non-reportable ones that may be a minor safety problem, but there needs to be resolution on them. And as I noted, we're going to be conducting an evaluation of the implementation of SMS over the next 9 to 12 months. These are just housekeeping program management notes. As I mentioned, the safety department has been good enough to provide us with three hotel stations within their facility. Obviously, these are not only for us. Other outside agencies can use them. But this has been a great help to us, especially with, full-time members like myself and Mr. Benton from Maryland, facilitate our ability to sit down, not get in anybody's way, not take over anyone's office, and review some of the material, whether it's for Maximo, whether it's internal reports, right there. On a sort of public relations note, the TOC's going to be activating a 24-hour phone number in early April, which will be published on our website. It will be during business hours. It's going to be available to the general public to just general inquiries, but on a 24-hour basis, the number is going to be available to Metro safety officers who, based on procedures that we're going to set up, are going to be able to use that to more effectively make accident and incident notifications.
So if they make that notification to you on that number,
yes,
would satisfy our part of the bargain?
It will take the burden. In circumstances in the past, we require a Metro safety officer to make affirmative contact with a TOC member, so you can't call and leave a voicemail. If it's a reportable incident, you need to have a my handshake with someone over the phone. And that put the burden on Metro safety officers in the middle of the night. Maybe they were driving, you know, not that they would drive and do it on their phones, but maybe they'd have to pull over and wait to get to the scene until they could get to one of us. Now, they call a number, the number's always answered, and that will help them to,
great,
to not spend so much time dealing with us and to focus more time on their jobs. If you have any questions or comments, I'd be happy to address them at this time.
Questions from members of the committee? Ms. Hutchins?
Mine are comments, because I think this is a very outstanding report. I think we've made a lot of progress, and I think the part that I am most comfortable with now is the clarity that we can make as we try and explain the change of our safety culture and what it means in the organization. And I thought when you referenced the corrective actions, this has been one that has been a very difficult one for us, because it's always a big number, and the assumption is that there is some neglect that's going on. And I think your explanation has contributed to, I hope, a lot of clarity. And as we see these, that we can, I think what I'd like to see is the ability and that prioritization, that it's a clear signal as to why they remain there. That is, if it's new and it's fresh, that it has one level of understanding as to why, what is happening with it. But it's a continuous process. But we may never be able to see zero, and as you say, zero
I hope you
may
don't.
may not give the right message to people, and they shouldn't expect that kind of message.
Sure. And, you know, in the past, there was a large number, and it included a lot of overdue dates, and that was where the problem lay. Mm-hmm. But if there is a significant number on an ongoing basis, but the deadlines are being met, and the effort is being allocated based on your hazard prioritization, then that's good.
Mr. Downs?
I want to address the issue that you mentioned about an institutional apprehension over caps and audit findings still exist and must be overcome. There's a long history in most transit agencies of the safety audit and performance review process being a blame function, that individuals are focused on about individual mistakes rather than system improvements. This agency has a long history of that. I know it was not a characterization that was either intended or accurate, but the yard derailments issue and the train operators, without a better context from all of us, feel that that's a criticism of the individual actions. Well, in reality, it's a criticism of system safety, rules enforcement, discipline, training, and I think that we need to keep in mind that in order to get the full cooperation of the entire workforce, bus and rail, we need to make sure that we keep a constant focus on the improvement side of this and not the blame side of it. The other is an appearance that somehow with more deficiencies listed that the system is not going the right direction. My experience with several railroads is that an institution is never safe completely. You never win. You can never get to a point where you say, golly, we're really safe.
Declare victory and leave. Right?
We can declare victory and go home. Deficiencies and findings are an indication, in my mind, of a healthy, open, accountable organization about system safety. It measures it. It constantly improves it. For me, I expect over time increases in deficiencies. If you have a constantly dynamic, changing system, you need to be able to make sure that the system safety criteria, measurement, rules, training are constantly improving. So I take it as a sign of a healthy system that we actually continually list deficiencies and system improvements. If we ever go dark about that pipeline of deficiencies in system safety improvements, it will mean we failed ultimately about safety. So it's just a different context. It's a different way of thinking about this, and I think of it in a very positive light, that there is constant cooperation and a constant effort to make every single iota of the system safer.
I couldn't agree with you more. The continual identification and management of safety concerns, security concerns that get listed and followed up upon is absolutely, in our view, as an oversight agency, an indication of a healthy safety culture.
Yes.
Mr. Downey, thank you. Matt, I'm sorry I was late. I apologize. I wanted to follow up on the very last item, which is the phone number, which I think, thank you for figuring out a better way for our folks to alert you that something's going on that is safer for everybody, actually, it sounds like. My question, though, is during the daytime, first of all, I'd like to understand a little better how you all, what you're going to tell the public about this phone number. I mean, you're the safety oversight guys, but you could get any number of different kinds of calls once the number is out there. And I'd just like to understand what the handoff is if somebody calls and it's not about safety. What happens?
Or it's about safety, but they're calling talk instead of us.
Instead of us, right.
I think the best way for me to answer your question is to say that we're going to phone numbers for myself, you know, my work cell phone, my office cell phone, my personal cell phone number in some cases, have made it out into the general public a long time ago, and not just for me, other members of the TOC. And I think we're going to continue to address calls from the public, from government agencies, from the media, from employees and all the rest, the same way we have in the past, which is that if there is a concern from a rider or an employee or something like that, our first response is to ensure that it's referred to Metro and they're aware of it, and then we follow up with the safety or police department as necessary to say, did you close the loop on this? And if there's a problem, then we'll follow up. But Metro is the primary, should be the primary point of contact for people who have safety or security concerns or questions, and we'll continue to manage the calls that we get the way we have in the past.
Great, thank you.
Sure.
Other questions or comments?
Question?
Yes.
I join Mary in apologizing for coming in late, so if you've already covered this, I apologize in advance. But on the elevator escalator slide, it's noted at the end that there's been an assignment of a full-time escalator safety officer. What specifically is that individual going to be doing?
I defer to Jeff.
Yeah, what specifically is that individual going to be doing?
Well, working closely with the elevator and escalator group, individuals went through our basic training for escalators and elevators, and rather it be there hopefully fewer investigations and more auditing to make sure that we are following our preventive maintenance schedule and the activities that are associated with that, but then also working to conduct any investigations if so deemed necessary, rather in hopefully they're not as significant as some of the ones in the past. So it's just to stay abreast of what's happening, work with the escalator group, conduct audits and investigations.
What, just a follow-up question, what is different from TOC's perspective, if anything, in your relationship with WMATA when it comes to escalator accidents as opposed to train or other incidents? I mean, how are those handled by TOC? When are you prompted? What is your point of contact? How does this individual work into that?
They're handled much, incidents on escalators are handled much the same way as incidents in stations, yards, rail vehicles, anything like that. It's an incident on rail transit control property, so the reporting criteria are the same as for, you know, an incident anywhere else within the system. The safety department has been very good about notifying us above and beyond of certain incidents that may not meet our reportability criteria but clearly present a potential hazard to the system. That was how we got our notification, for example, of the February 18th incident. There was no evacuation. There was no one injured. The damage had not been quantified yet, but they notify us through the same channels and processes that they do of other incidents. And so from that perspective, we're satisfied with where they are for the time being. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. Thank you.
Any other comments? Well, let me thank you for the report and for what I think is a developing good relationship. Never totally comfortable, nor should it be, but if we're moving towards the kind of organization that Mr. Downs described, this is a very useful function. Hopefully we're making some progress, but we always have more progress we could make, and we hope you'll continue to report on both progress and problems.
Sure. Thank you. We look forward to seeing you in June.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman? Before you go to the next item,
right.
May I take a moment
to
let you know, let everyone know that we have two of the new members from Maryland present, Ms. Artis Hampshire Cowan. Good morning and welcome, and Mr. Alan Nichols. Thank you very much, and thank him for joining us. They are not yet confirmed, but I appreciate and our board appreciates their attendance here at the meeting.
Thank you for making the Safety Committee your first visit. I view it as our most important function, and we need all the help we can get in performing it well.
Welcome.
Mr. Doherty.
Good morning again. Thank you, Chairman Downey. Jim Doherty, Chief Safety Officer. I'd like to take a moment before beginning actually the safety briefing, certainly to acknowledge, as you've done, the continued support and partnership that we have formed with the Tri-State Oversight Committee. And we actually also welcome today's briefing that they provided. We will continue to work together to address safety concerns and issues, which not only strengthens our system, but certainly benefits our customers and the communities and our employees. So I believe this briefing actually was primarily the talk briefing, but one of the things we wanted to do is to provide you a briefing from some of the questions that were raised during last month that we hope answers those questions. Next month is when we'll be conducting a more robust safety briefing, if you will, and discussing more on the corrective action plans and the status versus an overview. We'll delve down. We'll talk about the prioritization of the corrective actions that we have already mentioned and have a presentation for you on that, where you'll see how the corrective actions are prioritized following a military standard that we've adopted, which is also part of the Hazard Management Plan, which is Chapter 6 of the System Safety Program Plan. So first, I'd like to call on the Deputy Chief of Rail Safety, Bob Manishko, to talk about what we'll call an update on the rail incident, which is the February 18th Foggy Bottom escalator incident that occurred. Mr. Manishko.
Hello again. My name is Robert Manusco. I am the Deputy Chief for Rail Safety for SAFE on Mr. Doherty's staff, and I'd like to bring you up on the findings thus far on the incident that occurred February 18th at Foggy Bottom Station. Most importantly, there were no injuries associated with this incident. The unit was running up at the time of the incident. The incident was caused by a large rag or cloth that got caught up under the top right comb plate. That rag in turn caused the comb plate to break. That broken comb plate then lodged between two steps, causing a component within to break, which caused the step to displace. As the displaced step traveled on the return side and exited through the bottom comb plate, it wedged at an angle, causing several steps behind it to wedge and break. The lower up thrust switch tripped and stopped the escalator as designed when this occurred. The facts for here are that the incident occurred at 9:10 a.m. Supervision from elevator escalator, or Ellis, as we've termed it in the past and like to keep it that way, were on scene by 9:25 a.m. By 10:50 a.m., the broken steps had been removed. The unit was reversed back down to cover the opening that had been created by the steps that broke. The manual brake, often called a pawl brake, was set to allow the unit to be safely used as a walker. On February 19th, the next day, the new replacement steps were installed, and the unit was returned to service. The escalator is a O&K or Orenstein and Koppel manufactured unit. The unit was installed in 1992. Metro has 8 O&K units on the property. There are 3 at the entrance to Foggy Bottom. There are 3 at the entrance to Smithsonian, and there are 2 at the entrance to Metro Center. The Foggy Bottom O&K units were installed in 1992 and are equipped with a horizontal impact comb plate switch. The Smithsonian O&Ks were installed in 1993 and are equipped with horizontal impact comb plate safety switches. It should be noted that Foggy Bottom and Smithsonian were installed using the applicable 1992 code requirements. These requirements did not require a vertical comb plate safety switch. The Metro Center units were installed in 1998 and are equipped with both the horizontal and the vertical comb plate safety switches. It should be noted that the O&K escalators at Metro Center were installed using the applicable 1996 code revision that required a vertical comb in addition to the horizontal. As information, a vertical comb safety switch would possibly have detected the material that was drawn under the comb plate and could have prevented the damage by stopping the unit, possibly. It's a probability. The actions taken by Metro to date were that the preliminary investigation was completed by the Ellis Group. The escalator was repaired and back in service on February 19th. Ellis is currently reviewing equipment configurations of all of the other models we have for any similar situations. And BTX has once again been retained by Ellis to evaluate our findings at the conclusion of the investigation.
Any questions?
Yes. You said that the safety feature worked as intended. How quickly, in a situation like this, would the escalator shut down?
These are organized. From what I do my research is on these as well, and the way that I interpreted this is not designed to do a hard stop because it would throw people off. So it brings the escalator to a gradual slow down and stop to prevent people from falling off. The exact time that lapsed from triggering that up thrust switch to the time it stopped is, I think, 3 to 5 seconds.
It wasn't supposed to be instantaneous just because any situation with that particular kind of elevator, or it's because that the broken part was underneath where people weren't standing
right? It's not meant to be instantaneous because you would not want to stop it instantaneous to throw people off. It could operate in both the downward direction or the upward direction. You would not want to throw people off by a sudden stop. It brings it to a gradual stop so people can slow with the escalator.
I know we had another situation where a step actually broke that someone was standing on. Was part of that situation that the escalator didn't stop immediately, but it stopped gradually? Was that part of the issue in that case? What I'm trying to get at is I can understand the issue about not throwing people off. That's certainly not something we'd want to do. But I'm a little concerned that there were 4 steps behind it that broke before the escalator stopped. If people had been standing on those steps, it could have been a serious concern.
I agree.
So that basically this is an issue that it's considered to be more of a danger to stop it suddenly and throw people forward than it is to possibly affect people who are standing on a secure step, but the step does not remain secure from the time the incident happens until the time the elevator stops. Is that basically the issue?
I'll have to get back and look further into exactly why, but what I read was the industry had this implemented as a slow stop to prevent people from being thrown, since there would be many more people affected by the event.
so I could look into that further and get back to you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Any other questions? No. Thank you.
Thank you. The last meeting, which is certainly what we've started to do customarily, are to provide you with some information of incidents that occurred between the previous board meeting and in this current board meeting. And to be honest, I would hope that we don't have any to share with you typically, but we did have a couple of bus incidents that we wanted to share that met on Wednesday, March 2nd, 6:38 p.m. at Benning Road and 17th Street. A Metro bus was stopped when it was struck by a school bus making an illegal right-hand turn. A total of 9 injuries were claimed as a result of this incident. 6 were transported, 1 individual from the school bus and 5 from the Metro bus, and the others, other 3, didn't claim to need transport at the time. The school bus driver in this case was cited for making a right-hand turn in front of the Metro bus. I actually, as we've seen, the bus was discharging passengers when, as you can see in the photo, the school bus went around the left side of the Metro bus and struck the left front corner of the bus. The next bus incident was the very next day, Thursday, March 3rd, at 5:18 a.m. in Annapolis and Mill Street. In this incident, there were a total of 3 injuries that were reported, 2 from the bus and 1 from the van, and all were transported, however, were treated and released. In this case also, the driver of the Dodge Caravan was cited by police also, and certainly it can definitely see the difference in the damage resulting to the van that actually ran the red light and struck the bus.
Questions on the bus incidents? Thank you.
Moving into our safety statistical review, just some highlights, and as I mentioned, we'll have certainly a greater detailed report next month. But, you know, in the interest of the time of the committee, that we'll just cover some of the slides. There's additional slides attached for you or were included in the appendix. This is actually the key performance indicator for the employee injury rate that you'll also hear.
This will also get reported then as part of vital signs.
Yes, sir.
Yes.
This is part because we're actually, you know, want to certainly maintain the consistency, but this slide and the next slide provides you the, you know, where we're looking at from specifically a little more of a safety posture. And this is actually a new chart. As you'll see this on the bottom, we're actually moving to a calendar year versus a fiscal year. And this is for employee injuries per 200,000 hours that we talked about the previous time, and it's following the OSHA standard that we'd be bringing forth, actually. And there were 22 more injuries in January 2011 than 2010, and those were comprised mostly of slips, strains, and falls, you know, of employees, and certainly we believe that the weather had some impact on this condition.
I could make one comment on this chart, employee injuries. I know you have set a goal for reduction. I also note, looking at history, for the Class 1 railroad industry, Mr. Downs and I had some experience in, we began, when I was at DOT, a significant labor management partnership effort to reduce this kind of injury. When that started, the rail industry was at 6, roughly where Metro is now. Today, the rail industry is at 2. So this clearly progress can be made, and that's, you know, that's why we're working on this stuff.
That's correct, and we are certainly, as you know, with our actions, we're working with bus and rail transportation. Focus, there's a focus on local safety committee meetings, as well as investigating the occurrences to see what can we do better to make sure they don't occur again. What typically we look at what in the safety world we call the 3 E's: engineering, education, enforcement. So what can we engineer out, educate, continue through our safety awareness and promotion, and then certainly rules enforcement. And we'll look at what, you know, with the industry, also the railroad industry, as well as others. This next slide is the customer injury rate, and I'd like to note this includes all customer events. This includes whether it's bus, metro access, rail on board, escalators and elevators. This is all rolled up, you know, in this chart. certainly there's, and this is by million trips, and it's all, as I mentioned, all customers. You can see what we're doing. You have the January, let me see, just for the January, and you have the rest of 2010, so we're comparing January 2011, and there were 16 more customer injuries in January than in the previous month. And the majority of those injuries for the month, again, were slips and falls in the rail stations, you know, which those particular ones, though, would be excluded for the elevators and escalators. But overall, there was less than two customer injuries per day for the month of January. And that's looking at the average ridership for January was over 800,000 trips per day. Moving on to the corrective actions, as we said, we'll have certainly more information. But we didn't want to lose sight of the old corrective action plans, as Chair Downey asked us to make sure that we keep, you know, a focus on those as we are. And there are 18 remaining caps open prior to the 2010 triennial audit that was conducted by the Tri-State Oversight Committee. And then we've also added, as you'll, in this total, are the internal safety audits. We're including the OIG audits, and a few others, but I'll get into that slide in a pie chart. Next slide, Chris. 18 of the previous 256 caps remain open. Those include, as you can see, 9 from the 2007 TOC Triennial Review, 5 from the National Transportation Safety Board. Keep in mind that, you know, include the new ones were the recommendations made by the NTSB from the Fort Totten accident. 3 remain from open internal safety audits in 2007 and 8, and then 1, as you heard, we're working on revising our accident and incident procedure for the agency. And when that's done, that'll get submitted to TOC, and the FTA also is asked to review that procedure moving forward. This slide actually gives you an overall view of the various different corrective action plans that you've seen that we are working on, as Mr. Bassett had noted earlier. As you can see, there were 45% of the total corrective actions come from the TOC, 32% from our own internal safety audits that PROMOTA is conducting, and the 23% are the others, which are the inspector generals and investigations, potentially from accidents that would fall out of that. Then there's the National Transportation Safety Board recommendations and even the VTX for the escalators and elevators. So
of the total, 45% from TOC and 6% from the Safety Board, which are the third-party reviews, are just slightly more than half. The other half are things that we have initiated on our own and are working on, and carry them with the same degree of concern as the third party.
And that's correct, and that gives you a total. Basically, everything's been identified, and if we go out from day to day, we may find other issues that may get added to this list, and it's going to grow, but we're continually working to close it out. We meet with the TOC basically twice monthly. We have what we call a capture meeting, which starts off to look at the corrective actions, where the TOC looks at closing, what we provide, the information for them to close a corrective action plan moving forward, as well as even the OIG has sent a memo that I believe it's 5 of their actions have been closed out, and these all relate to safety. We don't actually include non-safety related plans, but they do. They all carry the same weight, and we are certainly working diligently to address what we identify, certainly as quickly as we can. And the next month we'll have the prioritization so that you'll know where they stand, where, that, you know, are they high priority that we need to deal with right now, or are they items that, you know, for prioritizing resources can wait a little while, or actually are a lower priority. I don't want to say wait a little while. General manager will be on me if we let wait too long, so we try to keep up with them all the time. So one of the things we wanted to do in the next slide is certainly show you that, you know, the TOC did make 127 recommendations or findings, which we certainly, you know, appreciate that. And we actually, of those 127, 36 were deficiencies that actually would be a something that's within a plan or a requirement that we have to complete, as well as there's 91 areas of concern that were noted. And I don't want to, you know, certainly won't read the definitions for you, but one of the things for a deficiency, because it's required, is the TOC notification for unacceptable hazardous conditions. That's a noted deficiency. We're working on that through the revision of the hazard management. We do notify the TOC currently of any unacceptable hazardous conditions that we identify
internally. Another deficiency noted is that we're not compliant with configuration management. There's others. I want to give you a couple of examples, and we're working on the configuration management, you know, as an agency to improve configuration management that shows that as things change, we have an accurate documentation. If you build something 30 years ago, if you make a modification, you need to update the drawings and everything so that in the event, you know, an emergency or something, you have that available to you.
And you do a safety review when those changes are made?
Yes, sir. Actually, those are all now flowing through the safety department. They're tracked. The operations group certainly sends all of them to us, and even all these work shutdowns that we've had on the weekends, we're reviewing the site-specific work plans, as well as we have staff out there during those shutdowns, you know, to actually, I'd like to say more to assist. If there's something that we participate on the morning briefing calls, and safety, I can tell you, is certainly one of the first, it's actually the first item discussed on those calls. Were there any injuries? Were there any incidents? So that's certainly, I find that very, you know, comforting more that this is certainly changing what we're saying in our safety culture. A couple examples of areas of concern, and they weren't necessarily specified, but missing or damaged acoustic tiles, which we certainly were looking at that. We put that in the maintenance group, and Mr. Kubicek's group deals with that, or broken floor tiles, things along that line. We want them addressed, but it just has a, you know, a little bit different level of priority in how we deploy our resources to address those concerns. And unless you had any further questions, we felt that would answer the questions that were raised at the February Board Safety Committee meeting.
We'll have a longer review next month.
Yes, sir. We will provide a safety progress report. We will talk about the corrective action plans, the prioritization, give you much more detail in how corrective actions are prioritized and tracked and monitored throughout the system.
Questions, Mr. Dorn? Yes.
I'll take advantage of my status as a new board member and ask a dumb question. How do you distinguish between preventable and non-preventable accidents, both the Metro Access collision and the bus collision?
What we're following is the National Safety Council standard for determining a non-preventable accident versus preventable. A preventable accident is defined as an accident that we did not do everything reasonable to avoid the occurrence. It's actually a higher degree of care, if you will, than fault, as a police department would issue a citation, because our operators are trained professional drivers following defensive driving tactics, and that's what we expect them to do. So that's what we look at, and then it also resulting, and I left the part, resulting in damage or property damage or injury.
So that a non-preventable accident would be something where not only was the driver not at fault, but he had done everything he could conceivably do to prevent the accident. So
correct.
Basically, that's the standard you're using.
Correct. And that would be an example, be it a bus at an intersection that stopped, it's in the lane the way it ought to be, you know, that it should be positioned in the lane, it gets struck in the rear end for a collision. That's the operator's doing what we train them to do, and they certainly don't have the control over the vehicle that's following behind them.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Ask the General Manager, Mr. Kubicek, do you have any comments on the safety reports?
All right. Just to repeat what was noted before, we're making progress, but we've got a lot more work to do.
Thank you.
Share the same thing. We have a lot more work in front of us.
Chief?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of this committee, and future WMATA board members. As you recall, back in February, we came before this committee and we presented the 2010 Part 1 criminal offenses, and we made a comparison between 2009. At that time, we listed the top 10 metro stations that had the highest number of Part 1 crimes, and one of the requests that came from this board was to drill down further and look at the top three. Well, we've done that today, and the top three stations with the highest Part 1 crimes are New Carlton, Branch Avenue, and Greenbelt, and they're all located in Prince George's County, Maryland. Additionally, these stations are what we call end-of-the-line stations, and dependent upon how you look at it, they're either the first station or the last station on that particular line. As a matter of information, two stations are on the green line, and one station is on the orange line. Next slide. It is comforting to report that the large majority of the Part 1 crimes depicted are crimes against property and not crimes against our customers. Additionally, our crime stats support the majority of our robbery-type offenses occur in the core of our system and not at the end of the line, stations, or in our parking lots. And over 90%, again, of our crimes in the top three highest crime Part 1 crime stations are property-related crimes and are occurring at the end-of-the-line stations, which for the most part are from customers parking their automobiles. Each of these stations have large commuter lots, serve as a large bus-to-rail transfer point, and also serve as other transportation hubs. We continue to look for innovative ways to prevent thefts from autos and theft of autos. And in 2010, we had over a 15% reduction in thefts from autos, and we continue to deploy different tactics and strategies to combat property-type crimes. Next slides. Our crime trends reveal the majority of our property crimes, again, are occurring in our parking facilities, which is the second biggest driver of our property crimes, which is also our bike-related crime. As the weather continues to change, we will deploy our decor bikes, as we have experienced several arrests in the past using this tactic. As far as our crime trends for crimes against person, the majority of our crimes are robbery snatches, which we realize that this is a crime of opportunity and is challenging to combat. As more and more customers continue to use a wide variety of electronic devices while utilizing our system, we continue to monitor our crime trends through our MetroStat process and actively address the deployment of our personnel to address hotspots and changing crime trends. We will be meeting with the Riders Advisory Committee in the near future to look at ways we can partner with the RAC and our customers in an effort to help educate customers and explore ways to enhance their safety and security. Next slide. In 2010, we experienced a 25% increase in arrests of youth. We continue to participate in daily conference calls with the Metropolitan Police Department and other entities of the District of Columbia to address youth disorder. It is important for the Metro Transit Police to work in concert with local law enforcement agencies to address various issues in and around our metro stations that are directly related to youth. As a matter of point, last evening, we met with law enforcement officials, nonprofit, corrections, and school representatives in Suitland. It was a citywide or countywide town hall on crime prevention in Prince George's County, which was spearheaded by Congresswoman Donna Edwards. And we had Acting Chief McGowell. We had Sheriff Melvin High. We had representatives from the school system. We had the nonprofit. And we were talking about solutions. How can we go about in Prince George's County addressing the problems associated with crimes? It was a four-hour back and forth, give and take, and we came away with some positive approaches to solving the problem and not necessarily just by arresting people. So we continue to work on that. Next slide. We will present our first quarter crime stats in the spring, which will be in April, which will reflect the first 3 months of calendar year 2011. This will provide an early snapshot of our current crime trends and compare it to criminal activity that occurred in 2010. We will institute outreach awareness campaign as the tourist season approaches and provide our first-time riders on tips how that they can travel safely in our system. We're in the process of realigning our various levels of management to provide greater supervision during the evenings and late hour activities. Finally, an initiative led by the General Manager and CEO, we will host a meeting in April with all of the local police within the National Capital Region to share ideas on how we, working in a collaborative fashion, effort to address criminal activity in and around our metro stations and on our metro facilities. We'll also discuss ways we can improve our communication processes and share in our intelligence. And that's all I have to report today. And open for any questions.
Thank you, Chief. Questions? Mr.
Chairman?
Yes. Marshall?
Yes, thank you, Chief. I had a couple questions about statistics. And when you present your statistics on the spring quarter, I'm interested in looking at how our robbery and larceny trends track against what's happening in the region. and whether these are kind of attenuated in the system or are they basically reflective of what's happening in the kind of the greater community, because I think it's a matter of trying to understand what's going on in our communities as a whole. So it would be helpful to have those statistics. Also, in terms of preparing for the summer, with respect to students, I know there were a number of incidences last summer, and are we also preparing or looking at how we're going to handle situations that may have occurred, say, at Gallery Place or at Longmont Plaza last summer, and how we will try to prevent or reduce those number of instances this time around?
Absolutely, sir. For the last several summers, we have developed a plan of action that sort of indicates how we will go about patrolling the various stations. We know when the summer is out, our school kids use our system to travel all across the National Capital Region, working with the law enforcement agencies and the deployment as we look at those locations that we know, based upon the time of day, the day of week, that we have the preponderance of our crime that's being depicted. And a lot of that is directly related to our young people, which is elevating up to about 40%. But we have those plans and actions. Again, we work with the local jurisdictional police departments, and hopefully through the efforts of the general manager, we will get additional assistance from the local jurisdictional agencies.
For new board members, I would suggest you schedule an opportunity to sit with the chief when they're doing the safe stat. It's every couple of weeks to get a sense of how resources are being deployed and how there's sort of a constant readjustment to get the best out of that, out of those resources. It's a very interesting process. Mr. Wells and then Mr. Benjamin.
Thank you, Chief. In your report, you state that 30% of the thefts or larceny is bike-related. Could you explain that a little bit more? Is that just like taking a wheel or a seat, or is that stealing the bikes themselves? And then the second question would be if you could explain a little bit more how the decoy bike program works and if you've been able to track its effectiveness.
Well, first, to answer your question, is taking parts of a bike. It's taking the entire bike. We sort of encourage our riders to utilize all means of transportation, and we have bike racks throughout the metro system. And so during the warmer weather months, we do have our share of people stealing the bikes. In the past, we have deployed decoy bikes at various locations based upon the crime trends, but that varies and it sort of spreads out across the whole metro system. And so it has been effective. To give you the exact percentages of arrests based upon the bike decoy bike program, I'll have to get back to you on that
one. Well, just on the decoy bike, does it have a tracking device in it? I mean, what makes it?
No, it is that. Well, is that location that we target, and we'll actively have.
So there's nothing special about the bike. You just put it there. There's no tracking device in it or whatever, and you just have a watch person.
Absolutely.
And then you watch for them to take the bike.
Yes, sir.
And then is there a value to the bike in terms of whether it's a felony or a lesser crime?
And that varies from jurisdictions to jurisdictions. Different laws that differentiate between a felony and a misdemeanor in Maryland, Virginia, and the district all varies, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Benjamin, Mr. Ewell.
Chief, we used to have a philosophy that if you prevent some of the smaller crimes, you discourage some of the larger crimes. And so we spent a lot of time doing things like making sure that people didn't eat or drink on the metro system, even though that's not a major crime. Is that still our philosophy?
That is always our philosophy, is enforcing a zero tolerance. However, as we enforce those public ordinance violations, we write a lot of citations. In the cases of juveniles, we write warning citations because we don't make a custodial arrest. However, even with the adults, we're finding that the court system views the minor violations as minor and the prosecution of that, you know, isn't up to par. And so quite often when we get to court, that case is no papered. So working with the various jurisdictional judges to see if, in fact, that could be elevated up to a higher level. And so any assistance that we could get on that end would be greatly appreciated, because we are spending money having our police officers go to court on overtime and find out that some of those cases for the minor violations that are annoyances to our customers and our patrons don't get prosecuted.
I applaud that, and certainly you've made a request that all of us as board members need to pay some attention to and see if we can be helpful. But beyond the issue of arrest, prosecution, I think there's a value just in a police officer going up to somebody and saying, are you aware that it's against the law to eat or drink on Metro? And not go all the way through the process of sending people to court and having to pay that overtime. Second question, I'm going to tie these two together in a second, is I understand that Gallery Place is one of those places where you have an increased presence. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
So I will tell you my last part, which is Tuesday night at 11 o'clock, I was at Gallery Place, on all the levels of Gallery Place, as a matter of fact, and saw numerous people eating and drinking. And as is my wont, I walked up to a few of them and let them know that it was against the law to eat or drink in Metro, and some of them actually paid attention and put away their food. But try as I might, I could not see anywhere any member of the police department. And I was hoping that perhaps, consistent with the philosophy that you said we had, we could increase our presence to look at those kinds of issues and at least go to people and let them know what the rules are.
You're absolutely correct, sir. In calendar year 2010, we actually issued over 6,600 criminal citations for eating, drinking, and smoking, as well as fare evasion. We also issued approximately 2,000 warning violations to those people using the system that may not have been aware of the criminal, the fact that you cannot eat, drink, or smoke. So we do that. To address your issue relative to not seeing a police officer at Gallery Place, I will definitely look into that and find out that particular time if, in fact, we weren't dispatched to some other location to make some apprehension. I have my Deputy Chief of Patrol Operations, you can stand, Tracy Simmons, who's in charge of our day-to-day operations and our patrol, and we will find out the answers to that question.
Thank you, Chief. And as I said, the importance may not be the issuance of citations. It may be just the presence and somebody coming up and talking.
Mr. McKay and then Mr. Downs.
Thank you, Chief. On your slide where you have the actions for the top three stations, part one crime, are we to conclude those actions are only taking place at those stations? That's kind of what the slide leads you to believe. Are those actions also taking place at many of our other end-of-the-line stations where we see larger than our customer would expect crimes, particularly related to automobiles?
These actions are taking place all over the system. However, in addressing these particular areas, we wanted to make it clear what things that we're doing in those particular locations. But as personnel permits, we're out there, we're doing the same type of concerted effort. We do look at our crime trends and locations based upon our Metro stat, and some of those locations based upon the type of crime, the day we direct our patrol to that particular area.
So some of these things are being deployed in multiple locations beyond the three that are listed on this slide.
Absolutely.
And as a follow-up question, of course, the jurisdictions in the past have helped assist with installation of surveillance cameras. I don't see that listed as actions here, so I guess a two-part question is, one, are those being deployed at these stations? And two, where we have those, are they being effective? And effective meaning, what prompts us to go to video camera review to help solve some of these crimes? Is it petty larceny that rises to the occasion? Is it, you know, stolen license plates? What actually prompts us to go to these cameras and try to solve some of these crimes?
Okay, relative to the update on the cameras, we met yesterday with the Washington Metropolitan Area Council of Governments and the Police Chief Subcommittee, and through the Urban Area Security Initiative, we got upwards of over $3 million for placement of cameras at 153 Metro stations. And the usefulness of that is that it benefits the jurisdictional agencies, that if, in fact, they were investigating a crime, they wanted to follow up on things, we could work together and have direct feeds to that. Thanks to Dave Kubicek and Mark Marshall Epler, we have the proposed configurations that we presented it to the area chiefs of police with two prototypes yesterday. And we finally got that approval, and we'll be moving forward. And hopefully within the next 6 months, we will have those cameras deployed at those instances to all of the stations. We also have an activity that, thanks to Council Member Graham in the District of Columbia, that we had gotten funding from them to put cameras up. All of these cameras will act to alert us of activity that's taken place, or if we want to investigate a serious accident on the part of an investigation that our chief safety officer is looking into, or any other activity, we can look to those cameras. We're hopeful that we can get smart camera technology that will tell us what it is that we're looking for, and so we're trying to integrate those, and thanks to the Department of Homeland Security and Transportation Security Administration, through which we got these grants, we are in a position, as many other transit agencies across the country, to utilize that technology to make our customers and employees safer day by day.
Just one last thought on that. You know, I hope that particularly the ones in parking garages where vehicles are sitting all day and where we obviously have serious theft occurring at some of those stations, that we also don't wait just for a serious incident to review the cameras and try to solve some of these crimes, because our suspicion is, and I've talked to folks in our jurisdiction about this, is the suspicion is very high that it's a very small number of people that keep going back every day. And while a theft of a GPS unit might not necessarily prompt you to do a video surveillance review, if it is in fact true that it's a small group of people that keep going back and taking advantage of this, then those small things might actually be a reason to have us review videotape surveillance in some of these parking lots and start solving some of these crimes. Because I do have a major concern about that. I mean, you're at the end of the line. It's not a crime against person. Folks know cars sit there for 7, 8, 9, 10 hours a day. And they may seem like little things, but let's make sure we use our technology to help solve some of the little things as well as just the big things.
Absolutely, sir.
Mr. Yule and then Mr. Downs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank the chief for the report, but I just have a question in terms of why I can appreciate the focus on the three top, high crime stations, but why no data on all the other stations, particularly the ones in Virginia?
Well, again, official report, the big report is one that comes out in May. And from my directions, we were going to be presenting on a quarterly basis the law enforcement and just providing updates in the other committee board presentations.
But, I mean, we certainly can conclude that your office is maintaining this information on a monthly basis, right?
Yes.
Can that be provided to us just FYI?
Absolutely.
Right. Thank you. Yeah.
The top three was really a response to a request that was made at the last comprehensive. Mr. Downs and Ms. Porter.
I want to follow up on Mr. Wells' concern about 30% of the larcenies in the system are bike related.
Yes.
Trying to remember, there are 60 some odd thousand parking spaces.
Yes.
For automobiles, there's about 1,500 bike spaces, 2,000 bike spaces in the system. The rate per space must be pretty horrendous to have them be 30% of the larcenies. A suggestion for the general manager. We have a capital budget going forward for the next 5 years for bike-related improvements and a bike and pedestrian access plan with targets and growth. The primary disincentive for anybody biking to a station is that if you bike, you might lose $150 worth of your bike equipment. Integrating the security side of bike planning as part of that process seems to be something that ought to be fully integrated about how those capital funds are allocated and the by capital plan. And I don't need an explanation for it now, but at some point in the future, it would probably be helpful to have a public committee airing of the integration of the security, larceny, capital, bike, pedestrian planning process.
I wonder, Chief, if you could clarify the chart on page 55 of 59, top three metro rail stations, part one, crime trends. I note that on the first chart, you're talking about total part one crimes for each of the stations in the 70 to 90 number. But on the left, there's much bigger numbers on that axis. I'm wondering what that what those numbers refer to. The next one. The next chart. Yes, on the left axis, you have larceny and robbery up there around 1,000, and I'm not sure 1,000 what?
1,000 part one criminal offenses.
And the top three stations, because you've got different numbers on the first one. You've got 89, 86, and 70. That doesn't add up to 1,000.
My apologies. This is overall. This is overall crime trends relative to larcenies, auto thefts, and robberies, and not necessarily at those three stations.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That's helpful. I have one follow-up question. If I'm looking at this chart, then it looks as if robberies is on a steep upward incline, and in fact, for 2010, is it exceeds larcenies. If I'm understanding, robbery is a crime against persons and larceny against property, so that even though crimes against persons are small, it looks like at least that portion of them is in fact increasing faster than anything else?
Absolutely. There has been an uptick of activities involving our young people and the snatching of the cell phones, and it's happening all over the city. And again, it's not just happening here in the Washington Metro, but other transit agencies across the country is happening.
So you're suggesting that's being driven by people essentially snatching, which is a form of robbery, snatching these electronic devices?
Absolutely.
And a lot more devices out there to be snatched. Yeah, Ms. Hutchins?
I want to go back to Mr. Benjamin's point in terms of the visibility and the opportunity to prevent and inform people about what the system rules and regulations are and how to follow up on that. We've talked about the eyes, and if Mr. Giancola were here, he would be asking how he can see more officers on the train. And I just wanted to ask if you could get back to the board regarding the knowledge of transit systems that use volunteer or auxiliary resources. Because I think it's very difficult to visualize the growth of our system and think about the active sworn officer on every car, yet the visibility of some person that can inform is a very important thing. Next week I'll be at a volunteer program which we will be acknowledging people for thousands of hours, and it's a reasonable commitment from not only our public to volunteer in a trained awareness mode, and not a large commitment from our organization. And it would be interested if other transit agencies are using that and how we might make use of something similar. I think it is very important that you see someone or someone acknowledges an act that doesn't look right. And I've experienced exactly Mr. Benjamin's, but I've often thought if it would be nice if board members had cards and you'd just simply say, oh, by the way, here are what the rules say. Well, I've never had one, but I've approached many people. But there is a point that when I approach them, I don't look like someone in authority. And they sometimes respond very positively, and they don't. But I think the view that there is a presence is very important, but the reality of sworn officers at that level is very difficult in our system.
Right. Many law enforcement agencies partner with Explorers. I think Fairfax County has a very good Explorers. We've just started an Explorers program here at the Washington Metro that will require some resources. Right now, I think we have roughly 20 members of our Explorer team that in the future we can build upon, that we can provide uniforms, that we can provide training, that can be a source of crowd control assistance. We do advocate letting the riding public know that it's against the law to eat, drink, and smoke through a variety of ways, signs. Sometimes, because Mr. Benjamin has many years here, and we at Metro have a ownership of this system, and he takes it upon himself to go out and tell the public that you can't do that. Sometimes, it can get a negative response, and we don't necessarily want to put people in a position to be assaulted, further assaulted, or to be degraded or anything like that. But if we're in uniform, bus operator, Metro uniform, then you're more in a position that you can say, please, it's against the law to eat, drink, and smoke, and not necessarily get any repercussions.
Well, I appreciate that, and you used the word explorer when you started that portion, and I'm thinking of a different level, because I think of the explorers we see as youth, but I'm thinking of the auxiliaries as people that are adults. So somewhere that, and I agree with you about the challenge of approaching someone and being able to get the appropriate reaction from them. And it is the uniform that sort of drives a larger level of that. And these persons are uniformed with a radio and the like, and that makes a difference. So I'd just be glad to hear what you can tell us in approaching that.
But, you know, we really do, and again, thanks to the general manager, that if we could get any assistance from our local jurisdictional agencies who protect people who are riding the bus or riding the subway train in their jurisdictions. If we could have them pop on a bus and ride for two blocks, say hello to the bus operator, or walk in the system in the jurisdictions in which they police, that would be an added boost. Until we get the opportunity to have additional police officers added to our force, any assistance from the jurisdictional agencies are, you know, greatly appreciated. So if that message...
I don't want to belabor this, but I just want to tell you, I think that's sort of pulling the same chain when we think about it. And I understand, and I believe that partnership is important. For example, the other week, I don't know what the activity was, but for some reason, there were a lot of police officers riding the train and probably coming to an event. But seeing three youth walk on with a carry-on lunch and open it up and began to eat is going to be one that's going to be hard to put in a police officer from the jurisdiction from the same way that you're saying versus someone else that might confront those. My experience with that is I'm not going to confront them, but I believe that other level that is a less costly piece to either the jurisdictions and the others is sort of what I'm pointing to. And I agree that the partnership is very important and having as many eyes to protect the system and, just more importantly, give assurance to the people that are riding that there's a safety element.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do you have a question?
I wanted to follow up, Chief, on what you said regarding the meeting that you had in Prince George's, where you kind of got everybody around the table to talk about working with the kids. I'm interested in what some of the positive ideas are that you all came up with.
Well, there are many ideas, and nonprofit organizations that provide mentoring, things of that nature, but they too were seeking funding from the, you know, the politicians because they felt that once law enforcement, which is always viewed as the person that provides the solution, in their mind, that was not the solution, and there should have been intervention along the way from grade school up, during the summer for activities that these young people could participate in, bringing them in, making them part of the solution. And so from their standpoint, they were looking to have more of those types of opportunities. to be presented.
Well, that's very helpful, and certainly in all of our jurisdictions, there's those conversations are going on. The question that I actually have is, have we ever worked proactively with the school system around the school systems around figuring out what the key messages are for young people when they start riding the system, so that they know how to behave, and that schools are helping reinforce some of those messages?
Yes, and over the course of the years, Metro has had programs, the police department has programs, their crime prevention officer, their McGruff, going out and talking about safety, talking about security, speaking at career days, and we have a lot of schools in the metropolitan area. And again, it is a request of personnel to go out and do that. And when we have limited resources and we need to put people out on the street to protect our patrons, you have to juggle and decide who's going to do what activity when, and we try to do as much as we possibly can. But
you know, Mr. Wells and I both served on the school board. Sometimes one of the ways around that is for us to develop that little curriculum unit and make it available. And particularly in the climate we're in now, we're kind of May and June, the end of May, beginning of June is a less intensive, because the tests are all over, time for the kids. School divisions are sometimes looking for that extra activity, those activities, and I would encourage, I don't know, the area superintendents all meet, as you know, at COG. Maybe there's a way to sort of float that idea and see if people would be willing, because I think everybody wants the kids. We're a transit-oriented region. To not welcome our young people into the system and with guidance about behavior, you know, there's always going to be bad actors, and I get that you're working with them. But
yeah, we're working with many of the school systems in the District of Columbia where we know we have some problems, whether it's Wilson High School or Dill or different locations, the charter schools. We're on a teleconference every day in the District of Columbia with the Metropolitan Police Department, D.C. public school systems, trying to find out where the possible activity will take place that will prevent somebody from being assaulted. So that's something that we do on a daily basis.
And I appreciate your focusing in on those places, but I also appreciate we've got thousands of young people who could be also that peer thing going on about, you know, these things are not acceptable in the system.
Absolutely.
So they're helpful as well.
Be the role models for others.
Good. I mean, role models for each other.
Mr. McKay had a follow-up on Ms. Porter, and then I think we need to wrap up.
I just want to follow up on Ms. Hudgens' comments, because I raised them before. I think many of my colleagues on this board know that I am one of those people. I'm a reserve sheriff's deputy in Fairfax County, and between our auxiliary police and sheriff's deputies, we save our county taxpayers millions of dollars in free service for special events, for, you know, responses to things that are unprecedented, and we, you know, find it very difficult many times to set these things up. It's not easy, but once they're up and going, they're very easy to maintain. They cost organizations almost no money, and they increase visibility tremendously. And I would think at a minimum, you know, you offer somebody free access to our system for a minimum number of hours of service a month and a uniform, you'd be surprised how many people would be interested in that. We live in a region here that is rich with law enforcement retirees from the federal agencies, from the local jurisdictions. We have great success recruiting them because they care about the community. Many of them probably traveled on the train in their work years consistently, and they care about this system. And if asked to volunteer in an organized program, I think you'd find a lot of support for that, particularly important in difficult budget times where we have a hard time with visibility, with filling positions. I think there's a great wealth of opportunity there that we should continue to follow up on. I think it should be a topic when you meet with the other regional law enforcement agencies from the jurisdictions as to how they do that, what assistance they might provide to Metro getting something like that started. I think there's enormous opportunity there, and I think this is a great time for us given our challenges, to take advantage of that. So I hope that recommendation is not taken lightly, and I hope it's one that when you lean on other jurisdictions for assistance, that that would be an area where they should be able to step up and help. I'm not aware of a jurisdiction in our region that doesn't have some type of program like that already, with varying levels of success. But I think it's something we should definitely take a further look at here.
It has worked elsewhere. Ms. Porter?
Well, I also wanted to support Mrs. Hudgens' suggestion. I think that's an excellent way to address what I think everyone on the board clearly thinks is an issue, which is that there is more need than there are officers available to patrol the system. And this sounds like an excellent way to address that. I agree with Mr. Wells. It probably would take some upfront investment, but it would certainly be something that could be very cost-effective over the long run. And I would also point out that we currently have, how shall I put it, some non-sanctioned volunteers serving that effort, which certainly suggests that there is a opening for efforts like that. Sure. So maybe we should be looking at putting some sanctioned and trained people in there.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And just one observation. I gather we were contacted this week by board members of the MTA in New York who wanted to talk about their interest in taking food and drink off their system. I'm not sure they're going to get there.
Well, I also noticed the chairman's response to that.
Right, yeah. Any other business for the Safety Committee? If not, we stand adjourned.